If the MOI ever suspected changing loyalties, they would not hesitate to put a bullet in her head before she could cross the border, a condition of internment of which she was well aware. She would stay put. Not only had she provided the names of U.S. intelligence sources in Iran, but she also helped reveal a covert communication network code named COVCOM, used by the CIA to securely communicate with agents in Iran, China, Russia, and North Korea. It was the biggest intelligence coup since the end of the Cold War, and it was Qasem who had been its mastermind. Intelligence gleaned from COVCOM served another purpose. It confirmed that the United States did not know who Qasem was or the role he had played in 9/11. Unlike some of his counterparts, he kept a low profile. Revolutionary Guard Quds Force Commander General Qasem Soleimani, Hezbollah Chief of Staff Imad Mughniyeh, Islamic Jihad leader Fatih al-Shkaki, and PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat had been relentlessly hunted for years. Only one of them had died of natural causes. It was important for the West to have their devils. Qasem planned to remain a ghost. He was more effective that way. While his contemporaries had become martyrs, Qasem would rather live for the cause than die for it. He'd stay off the radar to increase his chances of remaining above ground. Not even he had known what was coming. In 2001, he was simply a messenger, tasked to pass along a word. He'd taken that word from Iran, to Turkey, to Germany, to the United Kingdom, to Canada, and finally into the United States, where he'd whispered it to the man with the dead eyes. Qasem had suspected a truck bomb near the White House in the months ahead, not a multi-pronged attack using commercial airliners as instruments of terror the following morning. The Sunni-Shia rift was commonly pointed to by academics as the reason Iran could never have played a role in the attack on America. Qasem had listened to the experts on CNN, Fox, and the BBC for years. The accepted histories of the lead-up to that September morning focused on the Soviet-Afghan War, disenfranchised mujahideen, U.S. troops on the sacred lands of Mecca and Medina, the banishment of a Saudi son, and a Sunni group called Al-Qaeda. A convenient history for those accessing the past from an ivory tower. Those academics failed to understand the bonds forged between Al-Qaeda and Iran in Sudan after the son of the Saudi construction magnate was expelled from the kingdom. Al-Qaeda and Iranian leadership were not concerned with a 7th-century dispute of succession. They had a common enemy in the 21st century. Al-Qaeda operatives were sent from Sudan to train in Iran and with Hezbollah in Lebanon, adding tactics of terror to their battlefield experience from the land of the Pashtuns. The godfather of modern terrorism, Imad Mughniyeh, met with Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri in Khartoum, passing on the lessons of 1980s Beirut and the success of martyrdom operations against Western targets. Al-Qaeda was listening and learning. As Qasem worked his way up the ranks of Iranian intelligence, he'd learned the lengths to which his country had gone in assisting Al-Qaeda in the assassination of Ahmad Shah Massoud, commander of the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan, just 2 days prior to 9/11. The Sunni-Shia divide was a convenient talking point for the so-called terrorism experts on CNN. The view from the foxhole told a different story. Qasem had proven himself adept at orchestrating the proxy war against the Americans in Iraq while simultaneously infiltrating every ministry of the Iraqi government to include the office of the prime minister. Iran now dominated terrain from the Persian Gulf to the Mediterranean Sea, and had done so right under the nose of the American soldiers and diplomats trying so hard to bring George W. Bush's vision of Jeffersonian democracy to the Middle East. Dick Cheney, Colin Powell, Donald Rumsfeld, their arrogance had cost their country dearly and allowed the regime to outwit the enemies of Islam in the new great game. After his success pushing the Americans from Iraq, Qassem was transferred from the senior office of Iran's Ministry of Intelligence and Security to the intelligence organization of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, a more flexible entity established at the behest of the Supreme Leader in 2009. It gave Qassem the freedom to think and to plan. His mentors had taught him well. They had been the architects of a proxy war against the Americans for almost 40 years, ushering in a wave of suicide bombings targeting the U.S. Embassy and Marine barracks in Beirut. Their greatest achievement was contesting the religious ban on suicide bombings. Sunni organizations had eventually followed suit. They made martyrdom operations acceptable within Islam and successfully exported the tactic from the Middle East to the rest of the world. Qassem had studied their operations and identified the gaps in their ideology of terror. Truck bombs and airliners would not destroy a nation as prosperous and resilient as the United States. It would take something more. Fomenting chaos through proxies was what Iran did best. They were about to bring that expertise to the land of the free. The contents of a diplomatic pouch are protected under Article 27.3 of the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations, shielding them from any searches by a host nation government. Searching a properly marked diplomatic pouch, including via X-ray, was a violation of international law. And so it was that a pouch arrived in the mail section of the Pakistani embassy in Washington, D.C., properly marked as official correspondence with diplomatic pouch, clearly identifying it as protected material between Islamabad and its mission in the United States. Inside was another box labeled as property of the government of Iran and addressed to a member of their diplomatic staff. Even though the contents of the diplomatic pouch were protected by the Vienna Convention, Qassem took his time opening the box. The small vial within contained the death of a nation. In many ways, this was the most sensitive part of the operation. Once he passed the contents of the package to the asset, there was no turning back. There was no recalling it. There was no abort code. The poison would be released into America's bloodstream, and just like a cancer-ridden patient, America would turn against itself, compounding the problems of racial discord, Marxist-communist protests, a domestic insurgency, and the economic hit of COVID-19. This was the time to strike before they could regain their footing or rally around a foreign threat. There couldn't be a country or organization to blame, bomb, or destroy. It had to look like a naturally occurring event, and if the plot were uncovered, the menace had to have come from within. Nothing could tie it back to Iran. On this, the Ayatollah had been clear. Qassem had learned something else from the traitorous Air Force sergeant, a detail she didn't even know was important. It was why he continued his conversations with her. Initially, he'd been interested in the U.S. cyber warfare capability and what Iranian actions would trigger a U.S. nuclear response. Almost as an aside, she'd mentioned another protocol, a non-nuclear op plan more secure than anything she knew about her country's designs on Iran. She'd learned about it during a briefing in Hurlburt, Florida. Why, Qassem wondered, did the United States have multiple MC-130s from the U.S. Air Force Special Operations Command on standby in Florida, armed with GBU-43B bombs? And why was their mission a more closely guarded secret than the nuclear op plan for Iran? MC-130s were not a traditional long-range strategic bombing platform, like the venerable B-52, B-1, or B-2 stealth bomber. MC-130s needed to be forward deployed to a combat theater of operations to be effective. Why the secrecy surrounding this squadron in Florida, always on standby? How far could they fly from their base in the Panhandle? A Caribbean or Central or South America contingency? Maybe. But there had to be another reason to have those platforms on constant alert. Qasem was missing something. He made a trip to an apartment in the Tajrish neighborhood of Tehran, located near good shopping and restaurants but still far enough from the chaos of city center. The third-floor apartment was the last stop for a man who had once been a senior biologist at the Institute of Medical Biotechnology in Moscow. Following the collapse of the Soviet Union, he had been one of those recruited by Iran to help modernize its biological weapons program. The old scientist was frail and not completely lucid as he struggled to make tea for his guest. He'd given up trying to return to the Ukraine of his birth. He'd sold his soul to his masters in Tehran. This is where he would die. Valery Bakayev was not a young man when Gorbachev instituted his policies of glasnost and perestroika. With a wife who'd left him for a more attentive suitor, Bakayev was alone in the world when the paychecks stopped arriving and the Soviet Union dissolved before his eyes. The Iranians had recognized their opportunity and pounced. When presented with the prospect of dying alone of starvation in a cold Moscow apartment, or continuing his work in Iran for more money than he ever thought possible, Bakayev left Mother Russia with the clothes on his back and a lifetime of biological warfare knowledge in his head.
Contingency.
What do you mean, doctor? Qasem had asked. On this particular point, the old scientist's memory had been clear. Using the Socratic method so popular with those in the legal and medical professions, he'd led Qasem to the answer.
What would you do if a deadly pathogen you'd developed in violation of international treaty escaped your lab and threatened to infect a town, a city, a nation, the world?
We'd contain it, Qasem answered.
What else? What if it escaped the containment zone?
We'd have to kill it.
Precisely. And how would you do that? How do you destroy what can't be seen?
It must be eradicated.
In Russia, we had a protocol called Yasnevetr, cleansing wind,
the old scientist said.
All cities near our facilities studying the deadliest pathogens were on a target list. Biological weapon production facilities, bioweapon research labs, storage facilities, testing grounds, Zagorsk, Pokrov, Kirov, Omutninsk, Vozrozhdenaya, Aralsk, Nukus, Vladivostok. In the eventuality that a pathogen escaped, the area would need to be obliterated before the contagion destroyed the entire country.
The Soviet Union targeted its own cities for destruction?
It was the most efficient way to contain an outbreak that could have destroyed the country.
Are you sure?
My son, I developed the contingency.
Before he left the old man's apartment, a plan had started to form in the intelligence officer's head. He now knew what would lead a country to destroy its own cities. And he knew why those MC-130s were staged at the ready in Florida. Qasem would turn the might of the American military against itself. Qasem remembered the long-term penetration program he had helped design years earlier, sending young students abroad to study medicine to help modernize the Iranian health system. He remembered one student in particular. He would be perfect. First, he'd need to sell it through his superiors to the Ayatollah. There was nothing electronic to tie Iran to the plan. No emails, no text messages, no cloud-based spy communications network like the CIA's foolish covert system. This would be done the old way, the way of the Hashashin, the way things were handled when the Persian Empire was at the height of its power. This attack would restore Iran to its rightful place in the world order, reducing what the Americans liked to call a beacon of hope to a legacy of ashes. Chapter 10. Gillette Stadium, Foxborough, Massachusetts. They had met once before, at a football match in Germany. It had been a number of years, but Qasem and Ali had been trained by one of the most ruthless intelligence organizations in existence. They had not forgotten each other or the procedures for exchanging bona fides. Security was tight, with the Boston Marathon bombing still relatively fresh in the minds of those who attended sporting events in the cradle of liberty, but the plainclothes and uniformed officers were looking for something else, unaware that an attack was being set in motion in the very birthplace of the American Revolution. The spymaster and the assassin did not do a brush pass or a dead drop. They made no attempt to avoid the multitude of cameras covering the event. Leaving the bathroom, Qasem stopped next to a concession stand selling hats and jerseys to rub on hand sanitizer and adjust his mask. It was a blessing from Allah that the masks they were forced to wear at sporting events were now the accepted norm. Facial recognition software could take parts of the ears and eyes and put together partial matches, but it was not the tool of the state it had been just a year earlier. The Americans had tried to enforce six-foot distancing during the COVID-19 pandemic, obviously so they could build their databases, matching partials to build their sample volume and increase occlusion detection accuracy. Coverings were nothing new. Masks were just added to a list of facial obstructions, including sunglasses, scarves, and hats, so algorithms could make matches via an ear, an uncovered nose, or just one eye. The Americans are such sheep. If the intelligence services went back weeks from now and pieced together the meeting with partial matches from their facial recognition databases, it would already be too late.
Excuse me.
Qasem turned and looked into the eyes he remembered from their meeting in Germany.
Yes,
Qasem responded.
Could you spare a few drops of that sanitizer? I seem to have forgotten mine in the car.
Of course, Qasem said, holding out the small bottle.
Thank you.
Great game.
Ha! Not quite like those in Europe, but it will have to do.
Agreed.
Here, take this extra bottle. I have plenty,
Qasem said, pulling another unopened bottle from his pocket.
I couldn't. Please, I insist.
Thank you.
Mal safama,
Qasem said through his mask. With peace.
Fa'amfan alfa,
Ali responded. In God's protection. Ali touched his right hand to his heart and walked back to his seat to finish the game. For American soccer, it wasn't half bad. One of the deadliest toxins ever developed had just been placed in the hands of an assassin. Chapter 11. Club Aegis, Washington, D.C. Senator Edward Thwaites' black Suburban stopped in the alley on the 700 block of 15th Street, not far from the Treasury Building and within easy walking distance of the White House. He dropped his phone and tablet into a leather pouch that he handed to his aide for safekeeping. Electronic devices were not allowed where he was going. His aide took them without a word, knowing not to speak unless spoken to. He'd never been invited inside. He knew his place, out here, in the vehicle. The driver stayed behind the wheel while the detail lead exited the passenger side and opened the door for the senator, escorting him to what looked to be the back exit to any number of businesses whose fronts faced Lafayette Square. The senator nodded to another man who waited by the door.
"Please upstairs, sir,"
the advance man stated. "Thank you," the senator replied, taking a key card from his pocket and sliding it into the card reader affixed to the door. He punched in a code that was also his membership number and stepped inside with his bodyguard, leaving the advance man in the street. The senator much preferred arriving through the main entrance and taking the private elevator up to the second floor. This back entrance was installed during Prohibition, when the same people who outlawed alcohol needed a speakeasy nearby to enjoy a drink, regardless of who controlled the House and Senate. Hypocrisy was a constant. Today, the alley entrance allowed for additional anonymity, but did require him to make the trek to the second level on foot, a journey that left him slightly winded. It was almost a straight shot down Pennsylvania Avenue from Capitol Hill and offered a beautiful walk, though the senator had never exercised that option. Nestled in among the monuments, federal agencies, and museums for which Washington was famous, Club Aegis, or AG for those in the know, was the last true bipartisan private club in D.C. Membership was not based on political leanings. Republicans and Democrats were welcomed with open arms, if they could pay, if they had power, and if they could wait. The five-person membership committee was made up of three generations of the Marchetti family. Rumors abounded that there was a connection to what insiders called the outfit. The rest of the world called it the Mafia. Power was the currency traded upon in the high-backed leather chairs of Club Aegis. If Los Angeles was about sex and New York was about money, D.C. was all about supremacy. Aegis in Greek mythology conjured up images of a protective shield from the Iliad, an image reinforced by statues of Zeus and Athena that framed the bar. Members thought of themselves as protectors of the Republic, though the goal of most was to protect and grow their bank accounts. Senator Thwaite was a second-generation Aegis member, his father having served in the Senate for 30 years before Edward took over the seat. In his father's day, one would look around and see Kissinger, Abrams, McNamara, William Weed Kaufman, Harold Brown, John Rubel, Alan C. Enthoven, Maxwell Taylor, William Westmoreland, Olaf Helmer, Herman Kahn, and even a Kennedy or two, until that idiot Bobby started going after the mob, the very people who had delivered the Italian vote for his brother. That sort of idealism and treachery saw them both to early graves. The death of Camelot. True power still came from the barrel of a gun. Mao had been onto something. Today, men with the same pedigrees sat in the same seats. There were no fedoras in the coat room, but the windows were still covered with the same blood-red drapes to conceal the business within. The president could fool around in the White House all he wanted. It was here that deals were struck and budgets were allocated. Those who controlled the purse strings had the de facto power. What happened in the halls of Congress was theater, distraction for a gullible public who still believed in a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. No one would ever imagine that the world's most powerful nation was run from a 60-year-old cigar club on 15th Street. They entered through a dark corridor around the corner from the second-level bar. Thwaite handed his coat to the striking yet conservatively dressed hostess. His bodyguard took a seat at the far end of the best-stocked bar in the city and ordered an ice water from the tuxedo-clad bartender, keeping an eye on his principal in the reflection behind a sea of spirits. Thwaite opened the glass door to the walk-in humidor and approached his personal, humidity-controlled locker. He produced a key and extracted a Fuente Opus X, holding it under his nose and savoring the aroma. To Thwaite, it wasn't just a cigar. It represented his ability to impact the world. At 64, he still believed he had a chance at the coveted top job. It had been within his grasp until that brash young California Democrat started making moves. The new president was going to find out that it could get very lonely at the top. Senator Thwaite closed the door behind him, intentionally avoiding the corner table where he knew his appointment waited. He needed to send a message as to who was the alpha male, though he doubted the man would care. It infuriated the senator that nothing seemed to faze the former military officer. Doing his best to hide his annoyance, he made his way back out onto the floor, passing a waitress in a skimpy black dress. The all-male membership raised no objections to the staff's required attire, harking back to the building's original days as a whorehouse at the turn of the century. It had fallen into disrepair after Prohibition. There had been attempts at a few different restaurants, all unsuccessful, before an Italian family had purchased it in the late 1950s with outside investors from New York and Chicago. The downstairs home-style Italian food supported a profitable business, and the full menu was available to the private club on floors 2 and 3. The club refused to adopt bylaws, which allowed them to reject membership applications on a whim without fear of a recriminatory lawsuit. It boasted a 10-year waiting list for those willing to pay an undisclosed fee that would horrify most. Thwaite walked up to the third-level mezzanine, passing between a lion and a crocodile standing guard at the base of the staircase. Both floors boasted an assortment of African wildlife taxidermy and safari art donated by an early member, which gave the establishment the aura of a man cave on steroids. That same member had been hastily expelled and his membership revoked for getting drunk and grabby with a hostess. The arrangements made between the hostesses and club members behind closed doors were one thing, but making a spectacle in the club was grounds for immediate expulsion. They had kept his taxidermy as a final fuck you and a reminder to other members of the proper rules of etiquette. Thwaite stopped by a table overlooking the bar to say hello to Pietro and Franco Beretta, who were enjoying a meal with two members of the Senate Armed Services Committee, one of whom was a senator from Tennessee, where Beretta had recently moved its U.S. manufacturing facility. Thwaite shook hands with them all. He thanked Franco for the kind gift of matched 20 gauges he'd presented to Thwaite's wife on a driven pheasant hunt outside Gubbio, when they'd been guests of the Beretta family the previous fall. Loosely adhering to the U.S. Senate gift rules, the shotguns were given to his wife as a thank you for a speech she had given to Beretta's employees in conjunction with her corporate consulting business. In Club Aegis, it would have been considered rude not to offer a quick hello. One acknowledged the other patrons one knew and then moved on to the business of the day. He floated among the tables, shaking hands and making his presence known, hoping his sojourn was causing the man in the corner to sweat. He made sure to acknowledge the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations Low-Intensity Conflict, who sat drinking wine from the most exhaustive list in the swamp, with an executive from Raytheon, an untouched bowl of calamari between them. He only nodded to two tables of competing pharmaceutical companies, as even Thwaite found their ilk distasteful. He recognized a lobbyist for Purdue Pharma sitting with the chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee, and though the second-generation congressman couldn't make out what he was saying, the unmistakable southern drawl of the chairman permeated the air. The Sackler family minions had been hard at work to minimize the financial impact of the 2,000 state and local lawsuits filed to recover the losses associated with fighting the opioid epidemic. They had hired an army that included 22 separate lobbying firms to ensure they could continue peddling drugs to the most vulnerable segments of society, all the while reaping the financial benefits. To assuage some of that guilt, the Sacklers had plastered their family name over everything from university chairs to the wings of world-renowned museums. Thwaite wondered if that helped. The nail in their coffin was the recent publication of a book by Gerald Posner titled Pharma, Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America. It was being hailed as the 21st century equivalent of Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. Thwaite would be sure to reference it when the CEO of Purdue answered questions in Senate hearings later that month. Thwaite looked forward to watching him squirm. Though it might seem like a very public place to discuss such sensitive and controversial topics, that was the magic of Club Aegis. Business was conducted in plain sight, conversations disappearing along with the tobacco smoke into the state-of-the-art ventilation system. When the participants parted ways, like an unfamiliar perfume lingering in the wake of a forbidden affair, the only evidence that remained from meetings in AG was a hint of smoke on the conspirators' clothing. Bidding a good day to an executive vice president of Royal Dutch Shell, Thwaite descended the stairs. Returning to the second level, he took another three steps down off the raised bar area, leaving the original wood floor, and striding onto a black carpet inlaid with gold tobacco leaves. He slid into a leather chair the color of the finest Connecticut shade tobacco leaf before finally making eye contact with his appointment. The man across from him removed a thick Cohiba Behique from between his teeth and slowly exhaled, the gray smoke finding its way into the vents above. Even though he had no love for the Cuban government, the man had no qualms about procuring his beloved Cohibas whenever he was beyond the borders of the United States. While D.C. had banned cigar clubs and indoor smoking a decade ago, Aegis was grandfathered in, due in no small part to the powerful political connections of its membership.
"And how is the most underappreciated champion of the people doing today?"
the man asked.
Even though Thwaite had kept him waiting for more than 45 minutes, Eric Sawyer did not look the least bit disturbed. He didn't steal a knowing glance at the large Hublot watch on his wrist or inquire as to why the senator was late. He acted as if Thwaite was right on time. He was dressed comfortably in slacks and a sport jacket. As usual, he was not wearing a tie, something about it serving no useful purpose in a fight. In his mid-50s, he was a decade the senator's junior. His confidence bordered on arrogance, a trait unsettling to politicians accustomed to holding all the cards. His short-cropped salt-and-pepper hair betrayed a military background, exacerbated by a physique more befitting a man who was decades younger. Eric Sawyer was a born businessman trapped in the body of a soldier, and though he might be getting up there in years, his eyes and mind were as sharp as ever. He had read the tea leaves prior to the attacks of 9/11, merging the entrepreneurial spirit infused into him by a father who had left his children an inheritance they would not be able to spend in a lifetime, with his experience on the ground as an Army Ranger in Mogadishu, Somalia, in 1993. He returned home with a vision: to create a privatized intelligence and security apparatus leaner and more agile than the CIA and the U.S. military, services for which he'd charge a pretty penny. His timing could not have been better. Senator Thwaite's wealth came from owed favors. He was beholden not just to his constituents, but to donors, to lobbyists, to other politicians, family members, and reporters. Sawyer, in contrast, did not owe anyone favors. He had the financial freedom to sit on a beach drinking fruity cocktails in the sun at the home he kept on the island of Mustique in the West Indies, if he so desired. But that was not Sawyer's way. He could not stop building an empire that had grown to include government contracts worth billions over the past 20 years. He was both a patriot and a diehard capitalist. He provided something of value. It was rumored that the intelligence wing of his operation had collected information on more than a few of Thwaite's competitors. The senator had attempted to buy the information from Sawyer in years past, but the former ranger had only laughed.
That information, if it existed, was not for sale. He called it his get-out-of-jail-free card. He'd almost had to use it when a convoy of his contractors had hit an IED outside Gardez in 2005. Instead of retreating, they laid waste to a nearby village as a warning to not target their convoys. Unfortunately for them, a New York Times reporter had gotten wind of the atrocity and plastered photos of the dead, unarmed villagers across the front page. Sawyer had weathered the storm and even paid the legal expenses for the contractors involved. They'd still gone to prison, but the company had survived. As part of a public relations rebranding effort, Sawyer changed the business name to Masada. The following year, State Department contracts almost doubled, and classified contracts with the CIA increased tenfold. Thwaite could only venture a guess at the value of the information in the files Sawyer had gathered over the years. He wondered what information the corporate warrior had collected on him.
Just another day on the hill, Eric.
Thank you for waiting.
I was held up by urgent business in committee.
He hadn't been, of course, but Sawyer nodded politely in that infuriating way that conveyed he believed not a word, yet was not bothered in the least. A waitress appeared to take a drink order.
What is he having?
The senator asked, pointing to his companion, who casually took a sip from a crystal glass.
Pappy 23, sir,
the waitress replied. Sawyer swirled the deep amber liquid around the one large ice cube he'd requested to release the flavor.
I put it on your tab, Eddie,
Sawyer said. Attempting to not show his annoyance at being called Eddie, Thwaite stifled a grunt, wondering how many glasses of the $2,300-a-bottle Pappy Van Winkle Family Reserve the old soldier had put away while he'd waited. They were both members of the club, and Sawyer certainly had no need to charge it to the senator's personal account. He did it to toy with the senior man. Everything was a chess move with Sawyer. Thwaite pretended to take it in stride. He ordered a Bombay Sapphire Martini with three olives.
"Will you be dining with us tonight?"
the waitress inquired.
"Just drinks,"
the senator responded a little too quickly. Sawyer smiled, knowing he'd gotten to the aging politician. Mission accomplished. The martini was delivered swiftly, and Thwaite took too big a sip.
"Why does Sawyer make me so nervous?"
Regaining his composure, Thwaite pointed to the flat screen set to a cable news channel with the sound off and positioned in a way that only their section of the club could see it. A fellow senator was being publicly crucified. Allegations of sexual misconduct with female staffers and interns had surfaced, along with sexually explicit text messages. The Senate majority and minority leaders had referred the allegations to the Ethics Committee. The news commentator cited anonymous sources stating that he would resign rather than face the further public embarrassment of being censured and stripped of committee assignments. Due process in progressive America.
Mob rule. Cancel culture.
Thwaite almost felt bad for him, but the accused was a Democrat, and the senator would take his wins where and when he could. Thwaite then raised his martini to the screen.
"And once again, pussy remains undefeated."
Sawyer chuckled and took another pull from his Cuban cigar.
"How is the detail working out?"
Sawyer inquired. The team protecting Senator Thwaite was a Masada contract. In the violence that had ensued the following year, many politicians had added additional security to their routines, Thwaite among them. Sawyer didn't discriminate in taking contracts and even found satisfaction watching a politician call for additional gun control at rallies while armed Masada contractors stood just feet away, protecting that same politician with the very gun they wanted to ban. They were all such hacks. Sawyer would gladly take money from both sides.
"My driver has a lead foot. This isn't Baghdad,"
the senator said, feeling like he had to say something disparaging.
I'll be sure to let him know, Sawyer said, having no intention of doing so. Not even sure why you need the detail with that six-shooter on your left ankle.
Eric was one of the few people who knew about the senator's pistol, and now Thwaite regretted ever telling the former army officer, as he never let an opportunity pass to disparage the heirloom.
You know that was a gift from my father. He carried it all his years in the Senate, and I continue the tradition.
When was the last time you shot it?
Thwaite fumed, struggling to maintain his composure.
Why don't you come down to the Masada training facility and let me get one of our armorers to work up a Glock for you? Trigger job, full wrap stipple, barrel, slide cuts, RMR, the works. We will get you all set up with a real pistol. We'll even put you through some training. On us.
I appreciate the offer,
the senator replied, knowing the only reason Sawyer wanted him on the range was to humiliate him.
I think I will stick with my paid security and continue my business of running the country, thank you.
As you wish, Senator. Now, I'd love to drink bourbon on your tab all evening, but I do have other business to attend to. What can I do for you?
Don't fuck with me, Eric. I'm not in the mood.
He finished the martini and signaled the waitress for another.
What if you could fight a war without firing a bullet?
Is it still a war?
The senator asked. Sawyer studied the elder statesman sitting across from him, raised an eyebrow, and took another sip of bourbon.
That, Senator, is the highest level of warfare.
This country is at war.
Yes, I'm aware.
Not overseas, Eric. Here at home.
Sawyer knew when to let others talk. Interrogators often found that by being silent, they allowed their subject to fill the void with information they would never have extracted via more ruthless methods.
We are in the middle of a war for our very existence. A war of subversion. Bullets are not flying between north and south, east and west, red and blue, but we are already in the midst of a civil war, make no mistake.
Sawyer watched the senator clip the end off his cigar and strike a wooden match from a matchbox on the end table.
This war does not require bullets or assassinations in the traditional sense. It doesn't need a Che Guevara to raise a guerrilla army. The leaders have already been elected to state, local, and federal governments. Sympathizers have been infiltrated into our media establishment, entertainment industry, big tech, academia, even professional sports. Breitbart was right. Politics is downstream from culture. You don't need to take up arms in this war. Their weapons are hurled from social media platforms from which there is no defense, and the assassinations are character assassinations. Public executions come not from a slice of the guillotine, but by tweet, gleefully cheered on by the mob. You can fight it from your mom's basement as you eat Cheetos and collect an unemployment check from the very government you seek to destroy. It doesn't take courage, moral or physical, nor does it take resiliency. In fact, it takes the opposite of those once lauded traits. It takes apathy. You don't have to be creative, well-read, in shape, resourceful, or strong. The weaker your mind and body, the better. You can be taken advantage of. You are ripe for recruitment. Racism is the witchcraft of the 21st century, and cancel culture is the stake at which you are burned.
Thwaite caught his breath as his next martini arrived.
It's a cancer. It's infected its host. It was a slow-growing lesion and could have been removed decades ago, but it was allowed to fester under the guise of the very principles it seeks to destroy. Now it is going to kill the carrier, and there is nowhere for the remaining healthy cells to go. The U.S. was the last bastion of freedom. It was an experiment. That experiment has failed. The very ideals it sought to uphold are the ones that are allowing our ultimate demise. This is our last stand.
Nice speech, Eddie. You should think about becoming a politician.
The senator waved a hand of dismissal and rolled his cigar between his nicotine-stained fingers to ensure an even burn.
This president must not win a second term or the country is finished,
Thwaite stated.
You can vote him out in 3 years,
Sawyer said.
Don't give me that bullshit, Eric.
The Russian election interference is no joke, and they've only refined their techniques since the last election. This kid in the White House is only there because his friends in Silicon Valley manipulated their social advertising algorithms and swayed the election.
Really? Are you sure it wasn't creative marketing and a war hero's resume that crushed you at the ballot box? Or perhaps his opponent just wasn't likable?
Thwaite's face flushed red, but he pressed on, pointing back to the cable news program.
Those pundits keep warning of a coming civil war. It helps ratings, but it's disingenuous. That civil war is here. They just don't recognize it for what it is.
Let's say you and Yuri Bezmenov are right, Senator, Sawyer said, referencing the KGB defector who had warned the United States of a long-term Soviet subversion program to undermine free democratic societies of the West. What do you intend to do as the savior of the nation?
You had me tear apart Christensen's past in the lead-up to election. All it did was cost you much-needed funds that could have been used to bolster your campaign. Drastic measures are necessary, but we need to take the White House to implement them. The president met with someone yesterday at Camp David. I want to know what they talked about.
Let me look into it. Who did he meet with?
James Reese.
Eric Sawyer leaned forward and set his drink down on the table between them.
James Reese. The James Reese who dismantled the Capstone program a few years ago. The James Reese who saved the former president in Odessa. The James Reese who allegedly hunted down that CIA spy in Siberia last year.
I see you are familiar with his work.
He actually made Masada millions when he took out those Capstone contractors on Fisher's Island. All their contracts fell through when the company went down the tubes. We picked them up. I should be paying him a retainer.
Find out what the president talked with him about at Camp David. Something doesn't smell right about it. He's an assassin, and he met privately with the president. All we need is the hint of a scandal, and we can turn the tables. This cancel culture so popular on the left might finally work in our favor. Find me something I can use to bring down a president.
Chapter 12. University of Colorado School of Medicine, Denver, Colorado. Sebastian Phillips knocked on the door of his department chair of the Department of Immunology and Microbiology at the University of Colorado School of Medicine to say goodbye. Behind a desk strewn high with books and papers, a small framed Jewish woman sat across from a second-year female student from India. He recognized her from a thesis laboratory he'd supervised earlier in the year.
"Have a wonderful weekend, Seb. Any big plans?"
The Indian student turned in her chair and smiled.
"I'll get some mountain biking in before the snow hits. Other than that, I'll probably just be working on my dissertation.
Sebastian said, tucking an unruly strand of his long, curly black hair behind his ear.
I'm looking forward to reading the finished product. Take care.
Sebastian waved and nodded to his fellow student before making his way into the shadows of a late fall afternoon. He found himself wondering if either of them would survive what was to come. He made his way through campus, messenger bag over his shoulder and hands stuffed into the pockets of his bright blue puffy jacket. He still had a lot of research to do on his dissertation and was falling behind. He'd been distracted by another project lately. He tossed the bag into the passenger seat of his used forest green Subaru, his mountain bike still affixed to the roof rack, and slid behind the wheel to start the engine. He lived walking distance from campus, but as a fifth-year immunology student, he'd finally gotten a parking place because of the teaching duties associated with his degree requirements. He'd been driving a lot more recently. If anyone asked, he'd be able to point to his bike and use it as an excuse, saying he was going for a ride in the Rockies, which were still a bit of a trek from the Aurora, Colorado, Anschutz Medical Campus in a suburb of eastern Denver. Pulling onto I-225, he drove north before hitting I-70 west, passing the Bass Pro Shops and Safeway Distribution Center, the Nestle Purina plant, and the Coliseum. He then merged onto I-25 south and drove by Coors Field, REI, the Aquarium, and the Children's Museum, finally exiting the freeway and working his way to a house he'd purchased in central West Denver near Paco Sanchez Park, in a neighborhood time had forgotten. Just over a year ago, he wouldn't have been able to safely make the drive as Denver and even the streets of Aurora had erupted in riots. He briefly wondered if what he was about to do was even necessary. America seemed content to destroy itself without any provocation from a warrior of Allah. Sebastian looked forward to using his given name someday, but he knew the reason his parents had changed it before enrolling him in public school in Phoenix. It had been explained to him by the imam. Shahram Pahlavi was a name that made the infidels nervous. After he finished his studies, he'd revert to his given name and make the pilgrimage to Mecca during the 12th month of the lunar calendar, as all Muslims must do at least once in their lifetime, in adherence with the fifth pillar of Islam. His program in the Department of Microbiology in the School of Medicine had recently merged with the Integrated Department of Immunology. It was now a joint venture between the School of Medicine and National Jewish Health in what was obviously another move by the Jews to increase their power over the U.S. healthcare system. They already controlled the governments of most Western nations and had a monopoly on the international banking community. Shahram Pahlavi would be remembered for striking down the Zionist occupation government. That the very movement he sought to destroy was giving him the skills to strike a blow for all Muslims around the globe was an added bonus. He was almost ready. Parking in the driveway of the rundown single-story home, he locked his car and looked up and down the street as he fumbled through the keys until he found the right one. Weeds infested what had once been a lawn. The decades-old lime-green paint was peeling away from the siding as if trying to escape a community that wouldn't quite let it go. The bars on the windows matched the other homes in the neighborhood and added a layer of security Sebastian found comforting. The young PhD student locked the front door behind him and walked through the house as he'd been instructed, looking at his telltales to ensure nothing had been tampered with. Satisfied that everything was as it should be, he opened the door to the basement and descended the stairs. The basement had not been converted to a game room, home theater, bar, or man cave. Instead, Sebastian had used his knowledge of immunology and microbiology to build a high-tech virology lab. Clear poly sheeting lined the floor, ceiling, and walls. High-flow hoods with heat ventilation chambers wound via ducts to high-intensity UV exhaust ports that off-gassed like any home heating and cooling system. He did not want to accidentally obliterate the neighborhood. He intended on causing more damage than a single explosion could possibly produce. Anything he couldn't buy at Home Depot had been sent to his off-site mailbox at a UPS store in Denver and arrived from a variety of different life sciences and laboratory equipment companies so as not to trigger the suspicions of the FBI. Sebastian was pleased with his work, an expensive ultra-centrifuge culture cabinet cell separation hood, a device that resembled an uber-sturdy photographer's light box with flexible, thick, clear plastic partitions, was on a metal table against the wall next to a Nano Images Model 4500 scanning electron microscope. The microscope was a far cry from what he'd used in his high school biology class in Arizona. It could easily be confused with an industrial-strength espresso machine and was linked to a high-resolution computer monitor. He had followed his instructions to the letter. Whoever was directing the operation clearly knew what they were doing. Sebastian had not been told why he was building the clandestine laboratory, only that he must stay on schedule. The young doctoral student had spent months speculating about what he was preparing in the name of Allah. Patience.
La ilaha illa Allah, Muhammadun Rasulallah.
There is no God but God. Muhammad is the messenger of God.
The lab was fully functional when the African monkey kidney cells had arrived. He'd ordered them through the university lab as part of the research necessary for his dissertation. There was nothing out of the ordinary about ordering cells to one of the premier medical research universities in the country. A biosafety level 1 product, they had arrived frozen in liquid nitrogen and had taken almost a month to prepare. He had separated them into 15 independent cell lines and had confirmed they contained no contaminants and exhibited stable growth factors. Sebastian knew he was close. All that was missing now was a sample.
A sample of what?
Seb looked at the two DuPont Level A hazmat suits and respirators hanging on the wheeled pipe clothing rack at the base of the stairs. It was amazing what one could order from Amazon. Whatever it was, its handling called for fully contained biohazard suits, the same suits used in biocontainment level 4 facilities. That there were two indicated that Sebastian would not be conducting the next phase of the operation alone. Sebastian knew that he was waiting on someone who would bring a sample that almost certainly contained a deadly pathogen. In this makeshift lab, he and his unknown benefactor would transfer small amounts of what was undoubtedly an infectious disease in sample blood plasma to the cell culture plates of the monkey kidney cells. From there, the cells would replicate until they were ready for weaponization. After that, Sebastian could only guess. Chapter 13. Landini Brothers Restaurant, Old Town, Alexandria, Virginia.
So, what are you having?
Reese asked. Katie peered at him over the top of the menu and raised an eyebrow.
Your usual?
They were on the first floor, seated just past the bar at a corner table in their favorite restaurant, a Tuscan landmark in the heart of Old Town. It made Reese uncomfortable that there was no back exit. If something happened, at least he wouldn't waste time deciding where to go. They would fight their way to the front door. Reese's back was to the wall, and even though he knew the layout by heart, he'd still made his security assessment as he walked in. He couldn't help himself. It was ingrained. He told himself it wasn't paranoia. It was situational awareness. He'd lost his family because he had not been there. He wasn't going to let that happen to Katie.
Cheers, Reese said, raising his glass.
It irritated Katie that Landini Brothers didn't allow corkage, relegating patrons to their expensive wine list, which for some unknown reason didn't list the vintage. She tolerated it because the food was delicious. The charming old-world atmosphere appealed to her, and, unfortunately, there were few great restaurant options in Old Town.
Additionally, it happened to be walking distance from her condo. Looking at the wine list, Katie noticed two great Super Tuscan choices that happened to be among her favorites. Tenuta del Ornaiaia Masetto, which was egregiously overpriced, even though it was a tremendous wine, and Tenuta Sanguido Sassicaia, which was similarly an excellent bottle. With a smirk at the sommelier, who clearly had no idea what he was doing, Katie ordered the Sassicaia, which was mistakenly priced at half of what they should have charged.
So much for no corkage policy.
To what are we drinking on this fine evening? She asked. A weekend back from the farm?
Can't you think of anything more romantic than that?
She liked to make him sweat. She'd seen him under pressure before, and it never failed to amuse her that someone who could be so calm, cool, and collected when the bullets were flying struggled to find words when it came to matters of the heart.
Let me help you, Katie smiled. To us.
To us, Reese said, relieved.
See, that wasn't so bad. I thought they were supposed to be turning you into a suave secret agent down there. I was expecting you to come back all shaken, not stirred.
They're working on it, Reese said with a smile. I'm proving to be a tough case. It had been almost a year since Reese had returned from Siberia. Katie was less than pleased when Reese had gone off the grid, hunting the man who had killed his father and orchestrated the Russian hit team that had targeted and almost killed them both in the mountains of Montana. Reese was a man with grit. It was a trait she respected. It also terrified her.
Before I forget, Caroline Hastings emailed me. She wants us to come back to the ranch as soon as we can. Her exact words were, "Your cabin awaits." She says Rafe is getting antsy and wants to take you on a hunt. He still has a bit of a limp that she says he is very good at hiding from everyone. She also said the house is as good as new. All the bullet holes have been patched and the glass replaced. She made a point of telling me they've also emplaced additional security. I think she wanted me to feel safe.
Let's do it. I love Montana in the winter. Most people head south, which means there's just more of it for us to enjoy.
Wine by the fire beyond the grasp of these does sound nice, she said,
holding up her phone and making a point of dropping it in her purse so Reese knew he had her full attention. As she was hanging her bag on the back of her